This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 4,000, we're told today, is just a number. Each American killed in Iraq matters as much as any other. And we know some things about these 4,000 as a group. 98% male, 75% white, 9% officers, and the most common hometown is New York City. A little bit more than half were killed by bombs. And for most of us, our knowledge ends just about there. We don't know these men and women except as photographs on the faces of the fallen page or as subjects of the little paragraphs that, I don't know about you, some days I can stand to read and other days I simply cannot. Who were they? If your buddy, your friend, your brother, your son, daughter, your wife, or your husband is among the 4,000, give us a call today and help us understand a little bit about who or he or she was, about who we've lost. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org, and you can tell us your story on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, Barack Obama's White Side on the opinion page this week. But first, the 4,000. And we begin with Ursula Pirtle. She's the widow of U.S. Army Specialist Heath Pirtle. He was in Asada, Iraq, when he was the victim of a rocket-propelled grenade on October 4th, 2003. She joins us from her home in Fort Hood, Texas. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
And we're sorry for your loss. Tell us a little bit about your husband. What do you remember most about him?
My husband is the most beautiful soul I've ever met. He was tall and handsome and young and full of life and just so balanced, just the right amount of everything.
What would he have been doing if he were home now?
Well, he would definitely be enjoying family life, and he and I had dreams of having our own business together. We love working with our hands. He was a welder and worked with metal, and I like to work with wood, and we were hoping to do that one day together.
You have a four-year-old daughter, Katie. Does she know what happened to her dad?
She knows a little bit. I was 8 months pregnant on the day that Heath was killed. And so, you know, it was a little scary. We were hoping not to lose her as well. In the 4.5 years since then, she has seen his photographs every day. Dada was her first word. She always saw his picture on our living room wall and knew who her dada was. And now at this age, you know, she is very intelligent and she's very family oriented. She loves animals. She always makes families out of her animals. There's a mommy and a daddy and a baby. So she's aware of the structure of families, and she knows that her daddy is in heaven, that he died, and it's, you know, that's enough information for her right now. She accepts that. I tell her that he loves her very, very much, and that even though she can't see him or touch him, that he can see her and he watches over her.
And there are few of us who know what you're going through, but it must be worse on a day like today.
It's a little difficult. All the time, you know, there are days that are harder. He deployed April 10th of 2003, and that's the last day that I ever got to see him and touch him, which is going to be 5 years, you know, in a couple weeks. So that's a difficult day. He was killed in the beginning of October, so that October's a rough month, and then November was our anniversary, and December is the holiday, so the end of the year is always difficult. And even though it's been 4.5 years, you know, he was my very best friend, and I still miss him every day, and I still get tears in my eyes every day.
Would he have been following the basketball tournament?
He was a tall guy. He was 6'3", but he wasn't so much into basketball, so probably not.
What did he like to do? I mean, working with his hands, you mentioned.
He was a welder. He loved to work with metal. He would take plants and carve them into something. He would take the most mundane, everyday object and make something beautiful out of it. He was just very talented.
And I wonder, you still live at Fort Hood?
Yep, I live right outside of Fort Hood in Harker Heights.
And can I ask why?
I live here because we were having a home built. He never did get to see it finished. It was halfway done when he left. And it's right next door to my parents. So I do have a wonderful support here. I'm very, very fortunate, very blessed to have my family. I have two sons as well that are teenagers, and they go to school. They like, you know, having their friends and having their stability. So for us, having as little change in our lives as possible definitely made it easier to adjust.
Fort Hood has suffered more than its share of losses amongst the 4,000. Is there a support group amongst the families there?
There's a wonderful organization here called HUGS, H-U-G-S-S, which stands for Helping Unite Gold Star Survivors. And it's the only one of its kind that is a full-time center, and it's actually on base at Fort Hood. There's a physical building, Gold Star Center, and it's run by HUGS. And it started out as a simple support group for us to get together and just be able to speak with each other and share our experience and not feel so isolated. And now we actually are a nonprofit organization that gets to reach out to many families. And they do everything from, you know, having support group meetings to helping organize camps for the kids during the summertime, grief camps, because children grieve very different than adults. And we have parties for the holidays. We get together. It's a information network, like when, you know, the President Bush came to speak a few years ago. We all got to actually meet him in person. So it's a way to get together. And then also on difficult days like death anniversaries, wedding anniversaries, the center calls and just lets, you know, the family know that, you know, hey, if you need to talk, we're here.
What about the men who served with your husband in his unit?
You know, his friends are wonderful. I've been in contact with I saw a bunch of them when they came back from Iraq. They came back 6 months after he was killed. And a whole group of them got together and put some flooring down in my house for me, because it was a project. It was a big project that I couldn't undertake, and they wanted to do it. It was their gift for our family from their heart, and they took 3 days, and they did it all. And even now I'm in touch with, you know, several of his friends, and they check on us and make sure we're doing well. And a lot of them are out of the Army, and a lot of them have moved to other bases. You know, there's not very many here at Fort Hood actually anymore, but I get to stay in contact with them, and they've been really wonderful and supportive.
Where do you look for support other than these, your husband's buddies? There's an official support group, your family. Is there anything else that gives you comfort?
Actually, I work at a gym. I'm an instructor, and I teach a kickboxing cardio class, and you would be amazed at how much that helps.
No, I'm not amazed. I'm not surprised at all.
My anger management. I'm not a very angry person. I don't hate anybody, but just being physically able to combat something. It's a non-contact class. I don't actually hit anything, but just gaining that strength inside, you know, knowing that I can, feeling like I can take on things, gaining physical strength, you know, which also helps with my mental and emotional strength. I also went to counseling, and now I'm to the point where I just go every couple months, you know, just to check in. But in the beginning, I went twice a week right after Heath died, and my counselor was wonderful. And just having someone there to be able to tell everything that you can, everything that you're feeling. It's hard to talk to family sometimes because you worry about the emotional toll that they're feeling. When you're hurting, your family's hurting, you know, and it's like you don't want your family to hurt, but at the same time, you kind of need to share your feelings. So having a counselor, you know, was wonderful for me because he cared about me very much, but he, you know, it was somebody that I could talk to, and I didn't have to worry about how my emotional stress was going to affect him. So that was a really good thing for me. But I just have a positive attitude, and I try to look on the bright side. Acceptance has been the biggest gift for me, and accepting that was his day, accepting that his time in my life was temporary, and it was for as long as I could have him, and just extracting as much joy as I can out of our memories and realizing that this is the way that things were supposed to go has brought me so much peace.
Ursula Pirtle, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks. And I just want to say that I love my country very much. I love my family, and I know that I'm a very fortunate person, and my husband, his death has meaning, and that means a lot to me. It's, you know, he was trying to make a difference to many people, and he did.
Ursula Pirtle joined us from Fort Hood in Texas to talk about her husband, U.S. Army Specialist Heath Pirtle, killed in a Bradley fighting vehicle on October 4th, 2003 in Iraq. One of the 4,000. If you know one of the 4,000, if he or she was your son or daughter, wife or husband, son or daughter, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Who were they? Who have we lost? Kate joins us. Kate calling us from San Carlos in California.
Hi. I would like to let you know about my nephew, Brad Shooter, who we're coming up on the fourth anniversary of his death in Anbar province. He was killed on April 12th, 2004. It was his second tour in Iraq. I feel a little funny calling. It was such a terrible loss to his mother and father and his sister. So it was so terrible watching them experience that grief, and we feel so much grief on their behalf. But I have to say it's also been an inspiration watching how they, at the time that he was killed, there was no comfort at all, but that they've been able to carry on their lives, and some of the great things that they're doing since then is really good to watch.
Tell us a little bit about him.
Brad was, he was adopted by his parents from Korea. He was I think about 18 or 20 months old when they adopted him, so he had very good humor, and he made a lot of jokes about not looking like his family. He said he used to like to go to the mall and pretend they weren't his parents because nobody knew. This was when he was a teenager. He was very different in our family also because he was just Mr. Sociability. He loved to party. He could make friends with anybody. He was just the most outgoing and happy and vivacious person.
Kate, it sounds like you and all of us are going to miss him.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Four soldiers were killed last night in Baghdad when their vehicle was struck by a roadside bomb. They became part of a bleak marker. 4,000 U.S. troops have now died in Iraq. Who have we lost? 800-989-8255. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The war in Iraq passed its fifth anniversary last week, and last night it passed a dismal milestone. 4,000 U.S. troops have died there since the start of the war. There are an awful lot of ways to look at numbers. 1 in 6 was too young to drink. The most common age was 21. 11 died on a Thanksgiving Day. Another 11 on a Christmas Day. Today we're looking at who the 4,000 were with the people who knew them best. If you want to remember somebody among the 4,000, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Bill, and Bill's calling us from Bemidji in Minnesota.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling, remembering my son, Patrick, who would have been 31 on March 21st. He was killed on February 6, 2006. And I can only say that I am filled with rage over the way this fiasco has been handled. Patrick enlisted in the Army because he was looking for weapons of mass destruction that he was told were there. He was looking for that mushroom cloud that Secretary Rice said was a threat to us. He was looking for those unmanned aerial vehicles. He was told that if we don't fight them over there, they're going to be coming over the Rocky Mountains to fight us here.
Tell us a little bit about who he was, what he liked, what he dreamed about.
Patrick was a mountain biker. He would spend several thousand dollars on a bicycle. The only time that he would drive his vehicle is in the wintertime when it was the weather was too inclement. He was stationed at Fort Wainwright, Alaska, and he was deployed to Iraq. And he sent me an email the day before he left, and he said, "Dad, I'm excited to experience war, but I'm a little iffy about the dying part. I just think that were there any justice in this world, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the other serial killer that they surround them with would have climbed the gallows right after Saddam, because they're all cut from the same cloth. For what these people have done to our nation, these draft deserters and chicken hawks that did not serve, is inexcusable.
Bill, we're terribly sorry for your loss. Thanks very much for the call. Joining us now is Rick Turner, a retired Marine who survived a suicide car bomb attack on August 1st, 2005 in Iraq. That same day, six members of his unit were killed near Haditha, and he joins us now from his home in Akron, Ohio. And Rick, it's nice to talk with you again.
You too, Neil.
Okay. Rick was one of our guests when we took the program to Cleveland, Ohio, to talk about survivors of the war. And, well, Rick, today we wanted to ask you to talk about some of the people who didn't make it. What do you remember most about your friends, your buddies who died that day in Haditha?
It depends on which one you're talking about. They're all different people in many aspects, but we all had one common goal, was keeping each other alive and coming home safe.
That idea that... in combat, men don't fight for weapons of mass destruction or the country or the leadership, but for each other.
Right. Yeah, we're there fighting for each other no matter what we're there for. We're all there pretty much for the same reason, to make sure that every last Marine, soldier, sailor, airman comes home safe.
Which of them in their performance in Iraq surprised you?
I'm sorry, what's that?
Which of them in their performance in Iraq surprised you, and how so?
You know, I can't really point out just one. It was pretty much all of them, because, you know, everyone there did their own part, and, you know, they did an outstanding job. Every guy that I knew there, that I was with, that I was around, that I talked to, everyone was an outstanding Marine. When the Army was around, you know, when our corpsmen were there, I mean, everyone did their part, and they did an exceptional job.
And as you look at these men now, what do you remember about them? What do you think we should remember about them on this day?
Well, I think you should just remember that you know, they weren't there. They weren't there for nothing. There might be different reasons why we were sent there. The reasons might have changed. I'm not in politics, neither any of these men who died, and you know, so we don't have any control of why we get sent to another country to fight a war. But the one thing, like I said before, we're there for is to have each other's backs, to make sure that we come home safe. So when people say for nothing, you know, it makes me a little angry, but, you know, I think we were there for a good reason, as to make sure the guy next to you comes home.
And as you remember these men who did not come home, or at least did not come home alive, is there one in particular who became your friend?
You know, there was a lot of them that I was friends with and that I knew, and they were all brothers to me. Some were closer than others. The one that sticks out in my mind that I think about all the time, and actually still I talk to his family here and there, his name is Sergeant James Graham III, and he was from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he was actually in my truck when I got hit by a suicide car bomb. And, you know, I remember him showing pictures of his kids. I remember talking about his wife, his home life, his job. You know, you get really close to these people, and you get used to them. It's almost like, I guess you could say, because you're living with them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, the whole time you're there, and you just get to know very personal things about them. You get to know some things that you don't want to know about them, you know. But it's like living with a brother. That's like a sibling. You know, you might have your disagreements, your spats, your fights, but in the long run, none of it matters, because that's your brother and you're going to watch his back.
Now that you've been away from it for some time, it's hard to imagine that there will ever be anything that intense, that vivid again in your life.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever have anything like that in my life again, but I sure hope not, but... If I had an opportunity to serve my country again, I definitely would. I wouldn't think twice about it.
Rick Turner, thanks very well. How's your eye doing, by the way?
My eye's fine. It's my lower back and my legs that are still bugging me a little bit. But, yeah, I'm getting stronger and getting by. And I have a third son on the way. And, you know, my boys are keeping me active and keep me going. So,
well, thanks very much, and hang in there, will you?
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll talk to you again, Rick.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Rick Bye. Turner, who joined us on the line from Brook Park, Ohio, a medically retired Marine Lance Corporal. We talked to him earlier on Talk of the Nation. Let's talk now with Sean. Sean's with us from Akron, Ohio.
Yes, I was calling to bring back some memories of my sister's late husband. He was shot in 2004 in Iraq. His name's Brian Smith. In fact, he was one of the people who was in the Newsweek one about emails from the fallen. And he was very conscientious. In fact, the reason he's dead is because even though he wore all the body armor and everything, and he was deployed without the side armor, Mr. Rumsfeld's statement, you know, you go with the armor you have, and I won't go further on that. What happened was a lot of the tank commanders would either send their crew out to check running gear, or they just wouldn't do it because of lack of security. And he went out conscientiously, checked it each time, and a sniper got him where there wasn't any of the side armor. And he was a good commander. The unit he was deployed with at the time, even though it was, from what I understand, against the rules of engagement, went and got the two snipers anyway, for which I'm happy. But it's just, and of course, my sister's condolence letter was during the time Senator Rumsfeld was too busy and using an auto pen, so I've got my own issues with that, even though there's disagreements within the family over those. But he was just a good husband, and they'd been married 2 years. It's interesting because they had been undergoing in vitro fertilization, and they'd been trying before everything happened, and it was very sad and ironic that they'd had to send back the theater to get some of the permission stuff because he was gone and they wanted extra things, and the papers arrived 2 weeks after his remains. But she now has a very healthy little boy, and so she and his family have something to remember him by.
Sean, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Joining us now is Kevin Maurer, the former military reporter for the Fayetteville Observer, who's covered the war in Iraq since the beginning. He joins us now by phone from Wilmington, North Carolina. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And I know you're in Fayetteville, not too far from Fort Bragg there, and obviously many, many people from that area have been sent over to Iraq. And I know that one of the assignments you've had is to write profiles of those who did not make it back.
I've written probably too many of those, to be honest. You know, we did a it's an important story for us, and it's something that we put a lot of effort into making sure we get the best possible story we can.
And it's not easy sometimes writing to, obviously all of these are different people, yet you write that story 100 times or so. How do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it alive?
Well, you know, something we learned early on is that every one of these guys over there has their own story. I mean, they all have, there's some similarities to all of them, obviously, but, you know, every guy has his own reason. And what we try to do is keep it fresh is you've got to take forth the effort and find the information about these guys that really kind of brings them back to life, at least in the newspaper, so that, you know, the fair families read about their loved ones and the people read about their loved ones and understand a little bit why these guys do it.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. We did April Johnson and I, one of my colleagues there, we did a really in-depth story about seven guys that killed outside of Samara, and just two of them quickly. One of them, a staff sergeant named Justin Estes, his nickname was Dutch, and he had it tattooed on his arm. And when I talked to his mother about why he had that tattoo, she talked about that was, you know, he was of Dutch descent, but he became Dutch when he joined the Army. He was sort of not lost, but he was looking for something to do, kind of coming from Arkansas, got into the Army and really found himself. That she talks about how confident he was and everything. So that's one way the Army kind of changed him and made him into a man, really. And then there's a PFC, Corey Costers, from Houston, Texas. This guy, suburban kid, I mean, almost the classic American kid, played video games, was really smart, really computer savvy. And he joined the military because he felt like he had a pretty easy life, that he got a lot given to him, and he joined to give it back. And he was real conscious of the fact that he came from an affluent family and really worked hard to be one of the guys, and he was one of the more popular guys in the unit. So that's what you got to do. You got to find the thing that makes them interesting. That everybody's unique, and you got to just find that.
And obviously, one of the hardest things to do is to talk with family members who are just coping with the loss of their loved one.
It is, and you've got to be conscious of that. But something I try to talk to the families about. I don't force anyone to talk to me, but what I try to get across to them is that the more they talk to me, the more other people will understand their loved one, and the more that they'll have a keepsake. They can clip out the story and not only read about some of their own memories, but read about memories of some of his friends and family. And that, if you put the two kinds of stories together, the folks that talk about their loved ones, they're really kind of special stories.
We're talking today with Kevin Maurer, the former military reporter for the Fayetteville Observer. Just to let you know, he's still working in journalism. He still has a job. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Pat, and Pat's with us from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, Pat, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, my son, Sergeant David Kruder, was a Marine with Lima 325, an activated reserve unit out of Columbus, Ohio. On August 3rd, 2005, my son and his entire squad were killed, and our lives, we've been devastated ever since. My son had a wife. He would have been married 1 year. He had a six-week-old boy that he never had the opportunity to hold, and it was a tragedy then, and it's still been very difficult for all of us.
Tell us a little bit about him.
He definitely wanted to be a Marine. He started looking into it when he was in high school, and, you know, he felt very, very confident with his guys, and I have to admit, David led us to believe that he was very safe in Iraq. But I really believe that if anything happened to David in a fair fight, that the other Marines would bring him back to us. But David and the other boys were killed in a roadside bomb, so they didn't have much of a shot.
Didn't have a chance to respond to that in any meaningful way. As you think about, what do you think he might have done?
After he got out of the military?
Yeah.
Well, David was very interested. I think he would have gone to officer candidate school, and then after that time was probably look for a job in the Foreign Service or something with the government.
A man who wanted to serve his country.
Absolutely.
Pat, thanks very much, and we're so sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And I suspect, Kevin Maurer, you've heard a lot of stories like that.
Yeah, the sense of service is maybe one of the qualities that almost all of them have.
The sense of service.
Yeah, the military asks a lot of their soldiers, and I think one of the things that you'll find from all the soldiers is this idea of service, that it's bigger than oneself. You know, you're serving a greater cause than yourself, and that's something they take very seriously.
Mm-hmm. This number, 4,000, is there any way to calculate what this number means?
You know, I think by itself, probably not, but I think if you put it into the greater context of the debate over the war, I think it has some importance there.
In what sense?
In the sense that it's become 4,000 is a charge number now. I mean, it's become a rallying cry for both sides. I think you need to look at it, too, about the way casualties have impacted policy from, say, the Gulf War to Somalia to the Balkans and to now. You know, both sides will kind of take it and try to and use it for themselves. To, you know, and if you look at the anti-war, they're going to say 4,000 is too much. It's a waste. If you look at the folks that support the war in Iraq, they're going to say, you know, that if we leave, you've sacrificed 4,000 guys. You know, so I think it's a politically charged number, but I think it is going to have an impact.
It's interesting. We got this email from Barbara in San Antonio, Texas, who said, I know this is an attempt to honor the sacrifices made by individuals we've lost in Iraq and the families of these people, but this subject is just overwhelmingly sad. As somebody who was a young woman during Vietnam and has been to the Vietnam Memorial and shed tears there, this evokes the same feelings. My heart goes out to all of those affected by this war. And Kevin, yeah, 4,000, it's just a number, but we've already heard in this brief time about two men who left babies behind they never had a chance to meet. Sadness. You can't get around that.
No, it's impossible. And I think that's what makes it hard to cover sometimes. And that's what makes it hard when you have to call these families and do this. I mean, it's a number but it's not. It's each one of those guys, you know, has a story, and I think the phone calls that you've taken have illustrated that. I think if you read some of the stories that I've written and other reporters that have to cover this have written, you know, it's more than a number, and that's the important part of those stories, and that's why you've got to get out and really tell them, because these are us. This is us. This is our culture, our society. These are Americans, and that's the story you've got to tell.
Kevin Maurer, former military reporter for the Fayetteville Observer in North Carolina, with us by phone today from Wilmington, North Carolina. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
800-989-8255. Do you know one of the 4,000? This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from T. Rowe Price, mutual funds, IRAs, and college savings. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-Rowe-Price or troweprice.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And from Constellation Energy, working to develop new low-emissions energy solutions to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mike Rowe arrives at work another day, another filthy job.
You're going to get a little taste, so to speak, of what it's like to be a septic tank technician.
Yuck! I'm Neil Conan, peeling roadkill, castrating horses. Somebody's got to do it. Mike Rowe travels the country to try his hand at our dirtiest jobs. His next assignment, a guest spot on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The first American fatality of the Iraq War occurred on March 21st, 2003, and last night at about 10 p.m. in southern Baghdad, four more American lives were lost, bringing the total to 4,000. We're talking about the stories lurking in the grim arithmetic behind those numbers. If you want to share the story of a loved one who was among the 4,000, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Joining us now is Paul Schrader, the father of Marine Lieutenant Corporal Edward Augie Schrader, who was killed in action August 3rd, 2005, near Haditha, Iraq. He's with us from his home in Cleveland. And thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Neil.
And tell us a little bit about Augie.
A little bit. Augie was a person full of joy. Wry humor. His best friend said that you couldn't imagine him as a Marine because the hardest thing he ever hit was the remote on the television. Augie was a fellow who enjoyed being a member of a team. He was on every sport that you can imagine. Although he was no great athlete, he enjoyed the camaraderie of a team. While still in high school, he took a emergency medical technician course and passed the New Jersey State license, and so was a volunteer in West Orange and South Orange, New Jersey, more to be a team player than and be with a group of people who were doing something good. He did that through his church. He did that in a fraternity in college, and he joined the ultimate team, which is the Marines.
How do you get that nickname, Augie?
Well, his name is Edward August, and that was my father's name. And so we had an Ed, and I have a nephew, Ted. And before he was born, we knew that he was a boy, so we just started calling him Augie. And it stuck, and anybody who talks about him, if they call him Augie, we knew that he knew them well.
That part of New Jersey where he was working, that was particularly hard hit by 9/11.
Well, yes, 9/11 was... There's a park, and we lived in South Orange at the time, and there's a park there where you could see the Manhattan skyline. And after 9/11, I had moved back here by then, or my wife and I, and he was going to Ohio State. We're originally from Cleveland. And so after 9/11, we said, look, before you guys all run down to sign up, call us first. He signed up for the Marines in March of 2002, and he neglected to call us first. But I don't hold that against him.
I suspect not. We've heard a lot of passion on this program, I guess.
Yes.
How do you respond when people ask you if this was in any way worth it?
Well, we've responded in a couple of ways, three ways to be precise. First, my wife and I began speaking out the day after Augie's funeral and about what we thought about this war, which was not much, and what we thought was the cost. My son's number was 1824, so we've come a bit further since then. We kept feeling that at that time people were not fully aware of the cost. And so we, within a few months after feeling that we were just, oh, they're just grieving parents, time will heal all wounds, my wife and I decided to start an organization to lobby for an end of this, and this is called Families of the Fallen for Change. Our website is FOF Change, and we did that in November of 2005, and today we have 1,600 members nationwide. Most of them are veterans. Some are active military. Others are recently retired. A lot of Iraq veterans. Signed up. A lot of parents especially signed up, and not so many spouses, but more parents than not, and grandparents. And so that was our way. We began to lobby for an end to this war. We came up with our own plan to end this, which calls for negotiating with the provinces and the tribes rather than the central government in Iraq. And we took this to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We took this to Democrats and Republicans, and everyone said it's quite a unique plan, and we should think about this. We've talked to members of the House and the Senate. We've been lobbying ever since. Our website keeps track of fairly much what's going on in Iraq in terms of Congress, the administration on the ground, the human cost, etc. We also, I wrote a piece that appeared in the New York, or not in the New York, in the Washington Post in January of 06, called A Life Wasted, which explains my feelings about this. I thought my son's life was just thrown away. So, and the other thing is my wife ran for Congress and did not win the primary. So we've become politically active. We've been speaking out ever since.
So Augie's life is remembered and his death, too.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
It has to be remembered because it was, as I think, it was thrown away. So if we don't remember these deaths, and there obviously there are different opinions as to whether this was all worth it. I happen to think it was not worth it. This war was not, as Ken Burns talked about World War II, this war was not necessary. And so when you feel that way, even before it starts, and then it starts, and then you're caught in what we are now caught in, a changed, totally changed life, you have to acknowledge that. And what we have tried to do through Families of the Fallen is to put a human face, just what you're doing today, put a human face on all of these people, not just Americans, not just 4,000 Americans, but perhaps, more than half a million Iraqis, if you believe the Johns Hopkins study.
Depending on whose count you believe, yeah. Paul Schrader, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Paul Schrader is the father of Marine Lieutenant Corporal Edward Augie Schrader, killed in action August 3rd, 2005, near Haditha, Iraq, and he joins us today from his home in Cleveland, Ohio. One last call. Let's talk with Justin in Marshall, Minnesota.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, Justin.
I just wanted to call and talk about a close friend of mine that was killed. He was from my National Guard unit. I did not deploy with them for medical reasons, but he and two other comrades from our National Guard unit were killed by an IED in Baghdad on the 21st of February, 2005.
And what did you want us to remember about him today?
I wanted to remember his name was First Lieutenant Jason Timmerman, and I wanted everyone to remember what a caring individual he was. He was a teacher in civilian life, and he took that compassion and the caring for everyone, regardless of how anybody else thought of them, and he took that into the military life with him, and and made a great impact both as an enlisted man and then later on as an officer. And it's one of those stories from the National Guard side of things. My condolences to all the active personnel that have and their families that have been killed in this war, but from the National Guard side of things, someone that was taken away from us.
Thanks very much for the call, and sorrow for your loss.
Thank you.
People talking about the men they knew among the 4,000. Stay with us. When we come back, it's the Talk of the Nation opinion page.